Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at League of Education Voters. Nate Bowling is a veteran teacher trying to decipher the education policies and social politics that impact his students, his classroom, and his practice. I really like that, by the way.
Thank you. That's really cool.
He's a National Teacher of the Year finalist and a 2016 Washington State Teacher of the Year. In 2014, Nate received a Milken National Teaching Award, and he is the co-founder of Teachers United. Nate teaches AP Government and Politics and AP Human Geography at Lincoln High School in Tacoma and is also the host of the Nerd Farmer podcast. Follow Nate at natebowling.com. Nate, lately there's been a lot of focus on social, emotional health and mental health in schools and how to support students in those ways, but there hasn't been a lot of talk about physical health. What have you seen in terms of the need for physical health supports in the school here at Lincoln?
Students whose basic life needs aren't met have more trouble learning. And it's cliche at this point, because people have heard me say this a thousand times, but it's difficult to focus on like the minutia of the Supreme Court case that I'm trying to teach you about if your stomach is growling or you don't know where you're going to sleep that night. And so like physical safety and physical health is a factor that impacts learning. Kids who are distracted by safety issues and wellness issues aren't ready to learn. A metaphor that I've been talking about a lot is the United States military and the way the military operates. If you think about military service, we make sure that soldiers have quarters, gear, food, and health care to enable them to be mission ready. Well, if we want to apply that analogy to schools, we have lots and lots of students, and those students are clustered in certain neighborhoods who aren't mission ready. And somebody who's mission ready is going to be less effective.
That makes perfect sense. Have you seen this lack of mission readiness in your own classroom? And how can you tell that there's physical issues going on?
I see it all the time. I think in this particular political environment right now, it's very difficult to be a low-income student. I've got students who are suffering with issues around housing stability. They're suffering with issues around like family safety, around immigration. Students that are dealing with food security issues, whether it's enough to eat. And like all those are factors that are dilatory to student learning.
Do they tell you what's going on? I mean, how do you find out?
For me, teaching's relational, so I have a lot of conversation with students. You see a kid 180 days a year, you know when something's wrong. So you pull a kid to the side, you're like, what's going on? Sometimes they open up to me, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they need to see a counselor. But like there are just some basic like safety and life issues that students don't have met in low-income schools, and those things impact their learning. Now hear me, because I don't want to be one of those people that makes excuses for kids and says, you know, well, low-income kids. No. The most important factor impacting student achievement is the effectiveness of the teacher in the classroom, but the effectiveness of that teacher is limited or is damaged when a student isn't safe.
And once you find out that there are issues going on, what are the steps that you generally take to help get those needs met?
It really depends what it is. We have everything from, I have a bank of clothing in the back of the classroom, because we're in my room right now, full disclosure. Mm-hmm. I can offer students warm clothing. I keep my filing cabinets usually stocked with food. So kids say, hey, Bowling, I'm hungry. I'm like, here's a granola bar. Through Tacoma School's Whole Child program, we have a family support specialist in our building. And her job is to basically connect students with goods. Her name's Michelle Ha. She's an amazing, amazing school counselor. And so, for example, if I hear that a family is homeless at the time, I can send them to Ha, and she'll give them a Fred Meyer gift card. And what's dope about a Fred Meyer gift card is with a Fred Meyer gift card, you can buy groceries, yeah, or food, or gas. If I have a kid who doesn't have glasses, I can send them to Ha, and Ha can get them glasses. Essentially, like one of the things I've always thought about teaching is that we understand that low-income students underperform middle-income and high-income students. So what can we do to replicate the learning conditions of middle-income students in low-income schools? And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to take away all the excuses.
So what else does the Tacoma Whole Child program offer? Because it sounds pretty comprehensive.
The initiative began at the lower grade level and is rolling up to the upper grades. But basically, like the main idea is like, what are the needs that our students have that interfere with their learning? And we have a deputy superintendent, Josh Garcia, who's a pit bull, frankly, who's very dedicated to taking away excuses. So there's been some cooperative agreements between the Tacoma Housing Authority and Tacoma Schools about housing stabilization. We've had some community engagement with feeding families and getting them like food during breaks. A couple of years ago, our entire front office was turned into a food bank before winter break and before spring break, because you have kids who are dependent on two meals at school. That all now happens out of the Family Support Center, and that's happening at other low-income schools. And so it's a community effort. There's some conservative person right now who's listening and saying, like, this shouldn't be the job of schools. This isn't schools' roles. And like, you know, sir, you're right. Like, it's not our job. But like, if we don't do this, they can't learn.
That's what I was wondering, whether or not this sort of thing should be part of basic education.
It shouldn't be part of basic education, but It's what happens in schools, and if it doesn't happen, like, student learning is impacted. I can say, like, yeah, my job is to teach AP government, AP human geography. My job is not to feed and counsel kids, but if I don't, who will? It's kind of contingent on the nonprofit community and the education advocacy community to come alongside schools and provide services to our students.
Yeah, and that's what I was wondering, where funding can come from. Should it come from the state, perhaps?
Well, ideally the funding would come from the state, but we live in a period in which Washington State has the most progressive tax system in the country, and we have a surplus this year, and everybody wants to take the surplus to cut property taxes. And so I don't think it's coming from the state for those silly, silly reasons. And so I think it's on the, for lack of a better term, do-gooder nonprofit community to step up.
So how can we build more of these partnerships? Because there's certainly need beyond Tacoma.
Sure. The most important thing for us to do is just have, like, really intentional conversations. Up and down the I-5 corridor, there's these nonprofit groups, United Way of Pierce County, communities and schools, who, like, want to do good by students and do good by communities, but there's not always coordinated communications. What we really need up and down the I-5 corridor, and frankly in Central Washington as well, and around the country, is like conveners of choice bringing together communities, bringing together community service organizations, bringing together school leaders and community leaders and saying, like, what are your needs? I often find it funny because folks roll into Lincoln High School and say, hey, I brought all these resources, or I have all these programs for Lincoln kids, but, like, that's not what my kids need. And so you can't help a community you don't communicate with and understand. And so it's important that people who want to provide services understand the needs of schools and communities.
How do you authentically amplify community voice so that it can be an effective tool for advocacy?
I'm not sure that you can take community voice to scale because it's a one person at a time kind of thing. Like, there's a big push to not use war analogies in teaching, and I think they don't belong in teaching, but, like, counterinsurgency doctrine says that you win hearts first, then minds, and you're not going to win all the hearts with the same formula. It needs to be a case-by-case, community-by-community thing. Lincoln High School is very similar to Rainier Beach and very similar to Foster High School and very similar to Federal Way, but it's also not the same. Mm-hmm. And so the solutions that work here might not work there, but there needs to be collaboration between sites and between support groups.
So then is there a way to engage community beyond just individual meetings?
I would say if you're a service organization or you consider yourself in, like, the liberal do-gooder class here in Washington State, think about when's the last time that you spoke to a school leader. Think about when's the last time you spoke to somebody who works day-to-day with students and kids. I think about some organizations that are present in our building, like Treehouse is in here, helping our foster care kids. Frankly, between you, me, and the walls, and I guess in the audience now, I never even pondered the amount of chaos and instability that foster kids have and endure and how much that's dilatory to their learning process. And so you have to have conversation with people who are actually doing and engaged in the work. And this is one of the reasons I'm so passionate about teachers being at the table when policies being made. I love my legislators, but I know more about what's happening in schools and neighborhoods than they do. And I love my state senators, but I know more about what's happening in the lives of my students and what their needs are than they do. And I think a funny example of this, which is kind of timely, is right now there's a big push nationally about, like, gun control and student activism.
Yeah.
When I look at this activism and I think about my classroom, and I had this reinforced actually today with a couple conversations, my students aren't on board with that, not because they don't agree, but they don't see it as their problem. School shootings don't tend to happen at urban schools. That's an issue that happens in rural schools and suburban schools where, like, a gun culture and gun availability is a thing. When we have gun incidents at urban high schools, it's more like interpersonal, potentially gang-related stuff, or frankly, law enforcement introducing guns into buildings. It's funny because, like, basically my students are far more interested in, if you want to talk about, like, gun reform, they're far more interested in talking about, like, law enforcement policy reform and Black Lives Matter issues and what the police do. Like, that's the gun issue they're concerned about. Somebody who doesn't understand where I work in the context can come into the room and say, hey, I want to get you guys organized on this, but, like, that's not where their heads are.
How often do you meet with legislators to tell them what you know so that they can act on it?
So frankly, I'm a privileged person, right? So, like, I'm Teacher of the Year for Washington State. I've been published in the Washington Post. I've got a blog. I've got 10,000 Twitter followers. Like, I get more access to legislators than other people do. Like, I know that. I'm the legislative contact lead for Teachers United. Like, I get more access than most folks do. I just think in general, legislators don't talk to and listen to teachers enough. And I don't think they listen to me enough. And if they listen to me enough, then, like, they're sure the hell not listening to elementary school teacher in Kent who's being asked to bring toilet paper to school. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, that whole story in Kent, God bless them.
So what could a mobilization of teachers look like, or does it even need that? Because it feels like it shouldn't be on teachers to have to meet with the legislators. And there should be more outreach, I would think, from the state to what's happening on the ground.
I don't think we actually need a mobilization of teachers. What we need is people to listen to teachers. Teachers are out there telling their stories in all sorts of forums. Like here in Washington State, we have lots of groups that are taking teacher stories. We have the Washington Teacher Advisory Council. We have C-STEP. And they're taking the stories and the things that impactful educators are doing and seeing in their stories and collecting them. But the question is, do the public and the policymakers listen? So I have a couple of personal rules. If I read a story about education policy and the reporter does not quote a practicing teacher, the first time I DM the reporter and say, hey, why isn't teacher voice in this conversation? Why isn't teacher voice at the table? And then the second time, I do it publicly on Twitter. If I think about the number of ed stories that I look at in the newspaper, look at on TV, and think about how often I see people from the ed advocacy community and the, I want to be careful here, the people who are pushing policies, how often they have a seat at the table, and how often teachers don't have a seat at the table, that bothers me. I want to be really clear here and say that the union being at the table doesn't mean that teachers are at the table. I'm a member of the WEA, and I support the WEA on probably 80% of the policies, but that's not teacher voice. Like, teacher voice is the voice of actual practicing teachers. And frankly, if the voices of actual practicing teachers were heard more often in policy conversations, we'd have better outcomes here in Washington State.
What about students? How do we get students more involved?
Well, students absolutely need to be at the table as well. And that's another thing I'll say. I have a rule. If I get invited to speak someplace and it's a panel about education, I ask, am I the only teacher? Usually I am. And I ask, is there a student? And there's not a student, I don't go. We don't listen to students. The thing about students is that students know where the bodies are buried in schools. They know what good instruction looks like. They know who the bad teachers are. They need to be in conversations. My friend Lyon Terry is the teacher of the year before me, 2015, and he has an anecdote that I love. It's about data. And essentially, in Seattle schools, the number one indicator of what's happening with reading scores in a building is based on a student perception survey, do you feel safe in the bathroom? The stories that students can tell us from student perception surveys, from climate surveys, and from like actual conversations are huge.
So let's bring it back to student supports. What do you think is the biggest misconception that people have about what students need?
I don't think there's one answer. And like the needs in my building vary like year to year. So frankly, last year about this time, what the biggest need in my building was immigration lawyers to give guidance. There was a ton of uncertainty and frankly panic about the new administration and like what direction they were going to take, whether their families were safe. But other times of the year, like right now in wintertime, we know there's a burgeoning homelessness crisis here in Washington State. It's cold in the wintertime, so housing's an issue. It really varies from year to year. Stress is a total thing, like in the spring. I teach seniors, and seniors get very, very anxious in March about like planning for their future. They start getting financial aid offers, and they realize schools they wanted to go to aren't possibilities. And there's an emotional thing that happens there. Food security is an issue from time to time. I notice that students have more robust meals in the early parts of the month and the middle parts of the month, and less robust meals at the end of the month. Like, these are all real things. The Washington State PTA has strongly advocated for a breakfast after the bell bill. That bill's working its way through the legislature. I'm not sure it's where it's going to be by the time it comes out. But just like, if the least thing we can do is make sure that students who are learning in schools have at least two meals in them a day, that's an investment worth making in students.
Absolutely. How has your life changed since you became Washington State Teacher of the Year and National Teacher of the Year finalist in 2016?
I've had a pretty awesome ride over the last couple of years. The week I was named Teacher of the Year, later on that week, President Xi of China came to my classroom. I taught a lesson in front of him, and he kind of jumped in a little bit with my students. Wow. I've been able to visit the White House, the Vice President's residency. I've spoken at Harvard University. I've spoken at Whitworth College. All that's kind of secondary to the fact that like what I'm doing is trying to use my platform that I have in order to advocate for what's best for my community. And like that's one of the reasons why I struggle in the ed policy landscape. I'm not 100% with the union, and I'm not 100% with the reform crowd. For me, the policy lens that I put everything through is what is being proposed good for low-income white families and communities of color on the east side of Tacoma. And if it is, I support it. And if it ain't, I don't.
Nathan Gibbs Bowling is the 2016 Washington State Teacher of the Year and National Teacher of the Year finalist. He teaches AP Government and Politics and AP Human Geography at Lincoln High School in Tacoma. Nate, thank you so much for letting me drop in.
My pleasure. Thank you.